In her first book, A Gift from the Stars, Elena Danan gave sketches of 110 extraterrestrial races. These were black and white sketches. And what she has done is that she has produced colorized versions of those sketches with backgrounds and features that allow people to more easily identify and resonate with the beings in her new book, Encyclopedia Galactica.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome back, Elena. Great to have you on Exopolitics Today again.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me again.
Well, I have my copy of your new book, and I really enjoyed it. It is just full of information for people wanting to learn more about the different extraterrestrial civilizations out there. And so why don't you tell the story of how in your first book, A Gift from the Stars, you had these sketches and why you felt the need to upgrade those and produce them in a new book.
Well, in my first book, A Gift from the Stars, that I have here, I had made a guide of alien races with hand drawings. So this is, for instance, a hand drawing. And I had to do this book really quickly in 2020, in 4 months. So that was an intense work with hand-drawn sketches. And it was very intense because it was a question of safety. I had to go public as fast as possible in order to be protected. But always I had a kind of a frustration because I was thinking it's a pity because all these images, these holographic images that I was shown had colors. They were in colors. And I would have loved to provide A Gift from the Stars in colors. That would have taken so much time. So I kept that in the back of my mind and working very intensively on other books during the years that followed 2020, I was thinking I would like to produce a project of colorized guide of alien races, just beside my work. And this book would be more aimed at the star seeds for people to see with what alien culture, galactic culture, they resonate with. So that's how Encyclopedia Galactica started to see birth, the start of a project. And so that's it.
Now, I think it's worth pointing out, I mean, you are a professional archaeologist and worked as a professional archaeologist in Egypt, restoring ancient Egyptian artwork. So, you know, you're not just a talented artist, but this was actually part of your profession as an archaeologist. And in a way, I mean, that is like the perfect background for what you did with this new book.
Michael, it's amazing you're saying that because I hadn't thought about that, but this is so true. When I used to work in Egypt as an archaeologist, I was specialized in Egyptology. I am still Egyptologist, and I am also engineer in epigraphy. What is epigraphy? It is reproducing by hand drawing ancient artwork, carvings on the walls, wall paintings, statuary, architecture, take measurements and give a pictorial copy, a drawing copy, technical drawing. It was technical drawing I was working in. That if the artwork, the original antique, is lost or destroyed, that with the artwork, the survey, the artwork, the survey, you would be able to do it again produce a new copy of the artwork. So that's how precise it needed to be. And in a way, I am doing the same thing, Michael, with the galactic cultures. I get information, holographic information, and from these visuals, I am technically reproducing what I see, documenting these beings, and it's in a way the same work.
Yeah. To me, I see it as almost like a kind of like just a graduation or promotion from doing archaeology of an ancient Earth civilization to now doing a kind of like an archaeological or encyclopedic survey of the galaxy.
Yes, this is a survey of the galaxy. It is actually, that's what it is, because the artworks are nice, I suppose, but they are also technically accurate. Well, I would say accurate maybe 95%, because it's always a challenge, you know, to get as close as possible to the image you see. In Egypt, I had first hands, physical hands on the objects, on the artifacts. So I was able to take measurements and triangulations. But with holographic images, you cannot. So it's just up to you to record with your brain, with your capacity of recording. And I am really, that's my professional skills. That's what I do. I'm able to visually record and produce a kind of a accurate 100% copy if possible. You know, it's always swinging before 95 to 100%. I have to be honest, because sometimes it's difficult.
Well, in A Gift from the Stars, I mean, you had 110 extraterrestrial races that you illustrated with your drawings, your black and white drawings. And I, as I recall, they were races that were in some way connected with humanity or Earth. But in the Encyclopedia Galactica, you have a much more wider scope. I mean, this book, you have 150 races. In this book, but it only goes to, you know, from A to C. You're only going from I think it was Andromeda to Canis Major. So you're only doing the letters A to C and all the races. So how many races eventually do you think you're going to be covering in your Encyclopedia Galactica series?
I think about 1,000, maybe more. I am getting information as I go. I am going to attune, interface, well, that's the word, interface with the database of the Excelsior ship. And I am going to get one culture, and I'm going to work on it. So I know as I go, you know, I don't have the bigger picture yet, but I have the clearance to have access to only the stage 3 civilizations. Because the stage 3 civilizations regarding the Prime Directive are interstellar civilization, cultures who have by themselves developed the ability to travel out of their solar system. That's stage 3. If I had to document the whole life in the galaxy, it's impossible. It would be a whole library I would have to create, you know. There is so much. So it's only the interstellar culture, spacefaring cultures.
Okay, well, that's a good place to start. I mean, because humanity is an interstellar spacefaring culture, even though most of us, maybe 99.9%, have nothing to do with it. But the 1% or 0.1% that are involved in the secret space programs, I mean, they are an interstellar civilization or representation of our planet. So, yeah, eventually we're going to meet with these spacefaring cultures. So great to have a kind of like Encyclopedia Galactica.
Yes, and the way I had this information, there's a little bit of a upgrade. When I wrote A Gift from the Stars, Thorhan Eredion, my contact in the Galactic Federation of Worlds, was transmitting to me via my implant, my device, communication device, holographic images, and then he would tell me what they are, who they are, where they live. My implant has been upgraded in 2022 because I was starting to really get attacked and people were trying to hijack my contacts. So my implant was upgraded to a military grade of the Federation, a higher grade and more encoded. And because I have now this more encoded frequency, I am allowed to, it allows me, I mean, to access some data. The frequency is right, the carrier wave is right. So this time, Thorhan is not doing anything. I got the clearance to plug into this database whenever I want. And so I would get, I would say in my head, next, I place the intention next, and I would have holographic images. And it works by downloaded of information. So I would hear the name. So the names of the races are phonetical is how I heard them. Of course, it's not exactly how the ETs themselves will pronounce their name, but it's phonetically the most approaching. And then I have all this data that I need to type in English. And it's not over because I need to locate the star system. So I would have coordinates and just coordinates. And so with these coordinates that I write down the numbers, I would go on the NASA website and I would look for what star is there, what is there. And that's how I found all the stars. So it was long work.
Yeah, and that is fascinating. So this database that you're able to connect with through your upgraded implant, I mean, that has, like we were saying, I mean, that has a catalogue of the most significant spacefaring civilizations in our galaxy. Yes. And that you're able to reproduce that, and that it's almost like a kind of like a galactic internet. Or, I mean, people talk about the Akashic Record and tuning into the sun, like Edgar Cayce tuned into the sun to get the Akashic Record, to give people information on, you know, their history and illnesses and so forth. You can do something similar, tuning into some kind of galactic Akashic Record or internet where you learn all about the history of different extraterrestrial civilizations. Is it something along those lines?
Yeah, something along those lines. So I would have images. And that's up to me to try to transcribe them artistically the most accurately as possible. But I would hear this voice that would interface with my mind. It's like it's like a masculine synthetic voice that it's a computer voice that is it's in English. Well, it's interface in English for me. They all Thorhan all in set up everything for me. And I would hear that and I would type very, very, very quickly all the informations. And then I would really look over the notes with the typos and reform the phrases, sentences. But that's how it works.
Okay. Well, you sent me some of the images of the different extraterrestrial races that you described. So I thought maybe we could go through a few of these and just get a better idea of who you're describing, a little bit about their history and significance. So the first one I want to begin with is this Andromedan or Zenate. So you want to tell us about the origins of the Andromedans and what they have to do, what that has to do with the planet Zenate?
So it's in the constellation Andromeda, and Alex Collier is in contact with these beings. And we've never really managed to get an image, accurate image of them. So that's the image I was given, the profile I was given. They are in, it's Epsilon Andromeda, the star system, and they call their planet Titawin. they are highly spiritual beings. It's a very, very advanced culture, and they are at the origin of the Zenatean Alliance, or the Andromedan Council, how we know it best. And they are the head of this council, this alliance that gathers the most spiritually evolved cultures of this galaxy. So they are very important people, the Zenate, and most important about them, it's that they warned the galaxy that on Earth was the seed of a potential evil that would set a tyranny, a galactic tyranny. So, and we had this information from Alex Collier, the Andromedan contactee, a very long time ago already. You know, he was disclosing this. So it was my pleasure to get to see a holographic image of one of them. And I was like, wow, that's how they look like, because I never met any of them physically. So it was very interesting.
So Zenate is the name for the Andromeda constellation, as I understand it, and not a planet. And so this Zenate represents this alliance of civilizations, I think 140, that are part of the council. So the Andromeda Council, Zenate Council, I mean, we're talking the same thing.
Yes, the Zenate Council is because it's the Zenate. Zenate is the name of their race, their race. They are humans. Oh, yes, Zenate is the name of their race. They are a race of humans, human species.
I see. So those 140 spacefaring cultures that are part of this Andromeda Council, many of those are connected to the Zenate race?
No. The Ohorai Arcturians are part of it, for instance. You have different cultures. I wouldn't name all 140 of them, but not all are humans. No, not all are linked to them biologically.
Biologically. All right. So you describe them as having a kind of spiritual military culture, that they're really a kind of like a Jedi as represented in the Star Wars series. So you know, can you maybe just explain, and I think you did talk about the temporal war, so maybe explain how the way they operate as a spiritual military culture in bringing about balance in our galaxy.
So they are using spiritual principles such as cosmic laws, universal laws of evolution and respect of all life, to act, to produce actions. And their actions would be their very organized military type way of doing things. Although they will always act regarding bringing back the balance of things and bringing back higher frequencies, re-equilibrating the frequencies of a place, for instance, that had been lower down or attacked, or that had a planet or world that had endured an aggressive invasion. So they are here to help rebalancing the energies, and they work also on the consciousness. They are very wise people. And I'm not an expert on the matter. I just know what I get from the database. The person to really ask is Alex Collier.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there have been 22 genetic experiments on Earth, and that these genetic experiments can be traced to the 24 cedar races, and each of those cedar races work with different ET civilizations from within our galaxy. So in establishing colonies on Earth, was there ever an Andromedan or Zenate colony?
Yes, there was. Apparently there was, and they are, I think they even have an arc or two, maybe, I do not know. At least there's an arc there. I do not know where it is.
Okay, so for those that maybe don't know, when arcs are used for the seeding of a civilization on a world like ours, those arcs, after they've done the seeding, they get buried, they get hidden, but they lay dormant in case they're ever needed for, what exactly? Do you want to just elaborate on that?
So the Galactic Federation of Worlds, or I would say the Galactic Alliance that includes the Galactic Federation of Worlds and the Zenate Council and other organizations, they have a policy of helping worlds, each in their own ways, but it will always involve providing evacuation vessels or arcs. When a planet enters membership with the Alliance, with any organization within the Alliance, they will be provided kind of an armada of arcs. So the arcs will be either buried on their planet or either hidden in their star system. It depends on how easy it is safe to leave arcs on the planet. If the planet has an unstable political situation, they will not, for instance, they will not want that the arcs and this technology would be used for bad aims. So the arcs are first vessels just to, in case of an evacuation is needed. But not only, these arcs also, they are called arcs because they contain data and technology inside. So these arcs at one point will either help evacuate a world in danger or either be there to provide technology and provide knowledge about more advanced civilizations. And it would help the population on the planet to move forward in their evolution when they're ready by offering them this technology. So the arcs have two purposes, in fact.
Yes, and you have mentioned in one of the earlier interviews that these arcs, the crews, you said that there were approximately a dozen crew. So and they, of course, would be Andromedan starseeds or Zenate starseeds. And in addition, there might be Zenate starseeds that are here because they were dropped off or somehow get trapped on Earth. So is that pretty much the way it works?
Yes. Always the crews would follow the cycles of incarnation on the planet, always being standing ready if something happens.
Okay. Well, another civilization you describe Encyclopedia Galactica is the Tengri from TRAPPIST-1. So, yeah, I mean, tell us about those. That looks like a very interesting species.
The Tengri, I love them. They are very interesting. It's a Tengri who is herald at the High Council of the Galactic Federation of Worlds at the moment. It turns, so it's very interesting. Because was that planned with the Earth Alliance? I do not know. But in March 11, 2021, I received a message from Thorhan Eredion, my contact. And he said, James Webb Telescope will bring either attention or either furthermore evidence of life in the Tengri star system. I went, oh wow, okay. So I wrote an article and on my website, okay, the James Webb Telescope may point out in July, next July, to this system. And it did. When NASA broadcast, it was in July, the live, everyone was like, the TRAPPIST-1 star system. Oh my goodness. So that was not a surprise for me, but it was quite awesome. So who are the Tengri? They are a race on their own. They are cousins with a race named as well the Koldasi. The Koldasi are a very ancient people who are linked with the builders, the builder race, mysterious builder race. and the Koldasi have two outposts in our solar system. It's Venus and Neptune. Anyways, the Tengri-Tengri are a very ancient civilization. They live on the second planet of TRAPPIST-1. They live mostly underground because the conditions of their planet has changed and with time, and it's not as habitable as it was before. But they live half on the surface in domed cities and half on the ground. They are a spacefaring nation, and they have been in contact with Earth for a long time.
They are a fascinating race. I noticed those kind of tentacles almost. So I'm wondering in whether they have evolved from some octopi species, like because you know, that would be interesting to know in terms of evolution, how they evolved as an intelligent civilization and developed technology and so forth. Did their earliest origins come from, say, an octopi race, like a marine race, or was it some other origin?
There's something amphibian with them. I would say yes, because in the Koldasii, who are the original version of them, the Koldasii are really look like octopus-like. They are humanoids, as the Tengri, but you can really see it's not hair, it's appendix like tentacles, and it's moving. It's moving, it's not like hair, it's animated. Each strand has its own life, its own movement, you know. That's very, very interesting. As they think and they speak, the tentacles would move accordingly. If they have a strong emotion, the tentacles start to move quicker and with more amplitude. You know, if they are very calm, it falls straight. It's fascinating. There's a lot of octopi races I've noticed on different levels of evolution and different branches. You have even gigantic octopi-like etheric beings, notably the O in the cedar races. They live in space. They do not have physical body. They're just a supra-consciousness, but they have this shape, like floating octopi. It's apparently quite widespread genetics. It's very interesting. Fascinating, I would say.
Yeah, I think it is fascinating how you get these amphibians evolving, and the octopi could be a source for these amphibians like the Tengri-Tengri. So with this particular one, do they just have four tentacles, or there's more in the back?
It's about six. There are two more in the back.
I see. Okay. Well, I think the octopi, is it eight? They have eight tentacles, I couldn't see why. Maybe as they evolve, they develop six, or they lose two for whatever reason, or maybe two form into arms. Maybe that would be the way it happens.
The Koldasi, the original race from where the Tengri have evolved, have more than six tentacles. They have way more. It's like when you look at them, it looks like big dreadlocks. These tentacles, and they have plenty, maybe eight, maybe more, I don't know, but it's more than six anyway.
Okay. And I think it's worth just kind of emphasizing that you said that on the TRAPPIST-1 system that there would be a number of planets that exist that are habitable, and that this is where life has evolved. And the James Webb Space Telescope focused on the TRAPPIST-1 system first. And I think they confirmed how many planets were there. Or maybe that was done through some of the other telescopes like the Kepler, how many planets were in the TRAPPIST system. So do you remember that?
Oh, I don't remember exactly. I think there are seven habitable planets in the TRAPPIST-1 star system, but that's only the habitable ones. I think there are something like 10 or 12. Plus the moons, because when we speak about planets, sometimes you have planetoids, you have moons. Sometimes some planets are not habitable, but their moons are. Oh, it's more, you know, sometimes. Number is more.
Yeah. Well, another race, the Shungut, and you describe them as being the main galactic producers of red crystals that power ships. So, yeah, you want to tell us about the Shungut?
The Shungut, they come from the Apis constellation. The star, well, I need to look in my in the book to tell you exactly what star it is. There we go, the Shungut. The star is Toy 913. That's how it's repertoried. So they are producers of this red crystal. Their planet is 80% composed of this crystal. It's really akin to mercury dioxide, and this is used, they call it core, and this is used a lot in the core engine of the ships to power core engines. It can store an enormous amount of energy and give it back. So you would assimilate them to the dilithium crystals in Star Trek. It's exactly the same use. And this this core, this crystal mine, it is found in some places in the galaxy. But I have to say, on their world, it's really huge. The world is made of this nearly. The core at natural state is not doing anything. It's when traversed by pulse waves or pump wave or gravity waves that it starts to ignite and produce energy, release energy. It's very interesting material. It's red, like ruby red. So the Galactic Federation of Worlds straight away passed contract with the Shungut to buy and do a trade with them. And so their planet, because they accepted, their planet is surrounded by a shield and stations from the Federation who gather the crystals, they mine for them and they buy them. So the Shungut are very rich. They are very, very prosperous culture. They are reptilians. So, you know, that's interesting that we picked this one because it shows also that not all reptilian beings are nefarious, you know. The Sikar are horrible people, but not all reptilians are, you know, nasty as them. These ones are lovely people. They love arts, music, beauty. They adorn their skin with colors, flowers. They love arts and music, as I said. But you do not mess with them because they are very territorial. They are very territorial. You are welcome to their planet, but don't touch anything. It's theirs, you know. So, yes.
Yeah, I think that's so important that we distinguish between the friendly reptilians and the imperial reptilians, like the Draco reptilians and those that are allied with them. And I just wanted to get your comment about Earth-based reptilians that are also friendly, because we know ancient history, you have like in the Mahabharata, the Indian classic, they describe the Nagas as this kind of like a serpent-like reptilian race that actually helped one of the sides or the winning side in the war. And they would, as I recall, they were described as wisdom keepers and powerful warriors. So, how important are these friendly reptilians in terms of Earth history, and are they still here in underground cities?
The Nagas are related to the Tiru'u on Mars. The Nagas are more ancient than humans on Earth. They were there before everyone. They found Earth before everyone. But the problem is at the time, you know, every culture evolves. At the time, they wanted to get Earth for themselves, and they so they terraformed it, and they developed any reptilian life that was latent on Earth. They really developed it, and they terraformed it, suppressing chances for other life form to naturally develop. That's how you had dinosaurs and all the giant reptiles. Well, Earth became a reptilian planet. The cedars arrived around 65 million years ago, and they said, you don't do that. We are going to chase you and fight you and re-terraform Earth to bring Earth back at the start, to give all life form a chance to develop. We're going to reset it. So really bad events happened, and there was war. The Nagas went underground. Many of them were destroyed. There was a shower of meteorite or asteroids that really destroyed a lot, and then Earth was re-terraformed to give a chance to everyone, every life form. The Nagas who survived went underground, and that's where they elected residents for all this time. They developed into a peaceful culture, because they always said, Earth is ours, we own it, we were there before everyone. So there's a bit of confusion with that, but that's what they think. They're on their planet, they think that. They live underground, but they've learned how to live with other cultures of inner Earth, because they live near to the surface, between the surface and inner Earth. It's a bit the transition layer. And they've developed into becoming wise, you know, and helping cultures. It's true. They live more under the Asian areas, Asian continent. The problem is a faction of them was compromised and, corrupted by the Sikar. When the Sikar, which were the Alpha Draconian reptiles, and invaded Earth again. They tried to come many times, but when they invaded Earth a few thousand years ago, they found the Nagas, and they say, hey, you're also reptilians. You should ally with us. Most of them say, no, we don't want any problems. But some of them were corrupted and joined the Sikar in their agenda of, owning Earth. That's why it's sometimes confusing about the Nagas.
Okay. Now I want to talk about one of these other races, the Ulam Meratan, and in the Encyclopedia Galactica, you describe them as, inventors or distillers of the famous blue ale, which I guess is equivalent to like the beer of the galaxy. Like it's traded and drank everywhere.
Oh yes, the Ulam Meratan. They're from the Aquila constellation, and they are humanoids. They have sometimes you hear about the dog people. They're not dogs. They are humans, and they have this elongated face like a muzzle, and it's very real and weird. And they have some ridges on the skin, on the skull. Sorry, like this. They are very fascinating to observe. And the Ulam Meratan, they invented the famous Ulat, the blue drink, the bubbly blue drinks that myself and Jean-Charles Moyen have described to you, and JP as well, and many others have described. Some secret space program soldiers have also described this blue ale. And so these are the people, the Ulam Meratan in the Aquila constellation, who created it. They are extremely rich, as you can imagine. Their recipe is being produced by now many other cultures, but they own the rights. So every time this blue ale is being produced, they have a percentage on the sales. Of course, there is illegal blue ale. Of course, there's a lot of things happening in this galaxy. You know, you have the Galactic Guild of Merchants. There's a lot of things I'm covering in this book.
Yeah, as I recall, I think there was a kind of forbidden blue ale in the Star Trek series where one of the races specialized or used this blue ale, and it was banned in the Federation. So is that a kind of alluding to this kind of bootlegged blue ale?
In Star Trek, it may refer to the Romulan blue ale. Correct. But... you know, I'm not sure, but Star Trek is such a disclosure, you know.
Now, you sent me another race, which I thought is very interesting. This is the Kelt 7 star system, and you describe them as having a leisure and commerce hub similar to the one that's being built near Jupiter. So, yeah, you want to tell us about this race and the hub that they've built?
Yes, so the race we see on screen, they are the Vin, and the Vin live in the Kelt 7 star system in the Auriga constellation. They are not traders, but very into commerce, and they have created what is called Vatukat. Vatukat is a leisure center, galactic leisure center. It is based on their planet, but also they have several hubs in orbit of their planet. And when I was, I got information before I learned that the hub in orbit of Jupiter would be built. And then when the hub developed and the Jupiter hub developed and I was explained the different purpose, that sounds familiar. And then Vatukat, of course. Kelt 7, the Vin, so it's interesting to learn how this hub may develop. I say not maybe will, but may develop. There's a lot of chance it will develop like this. It's a commercial hub, and this Vatukat also, so the planet and the hubs in orbit of the planet. You have different cultures that have elected residents on these hubs and on the planet, and everyone is running their own specialties. And the Vin are specialized in, pleasure, leisure, and especially holographic reconstruction of reality. So you would see the equivalent of the on Star Trek with the holodecks, you know. The Vin are specialists of that. Other cultures are producing holographic entertainment and leisure reconstruction, parallel realities. But the Vin are quite known for that. So I think on the hub near Jupiter, we will certainly have a section for leisure, and you will certainly encounter these people you see there on screen, the Vin. They are registered by the Galactic Guild of Merchants officially to provide this commerce.
So they're kind of like the Ferengi in Star Trek, who really were all about commerce, and in Deep Space Nine they set up a pleasure center there for people that just wanted to, you know, go in and have these holographic highs. So yeah, so the Ven are kind of like the Ferengi.
Yes, in some sort. Yes, I haven't seen the information with what was given to me that they are very greedy with money, profit, like the Ferengi, but there's so many similarities.
Okay, fascinating. Well, one of the other races, probably one that's most widely known on Earth, are the Anunnaki or the Anak Empire, and you described how they arrived in our galaxy in the Boots constellation about 700,000 years ago, and when they arrived, presumably from another galaxy, they were led by Anu, who is still their king. So you want to tell us about the Anunnaki history and their importance?
Yes, so I'm happy that in the same book I could cover the complete Anunnaki history from Butes, because Butes is in it, and Canis Minor, where the seat of the empire is now. The Anunnaki come from a parallel universe. It's called Uraeia galaxy. I don't know if I pronounce it correctly. Nobody will blame me for that. They arrived through the Butes vortex. There is a big vortex, like a big wormhole, near the Arcturus star. So that's why Arcturus is quite a star that we speak a lot about, because there's this type of vortex near it. They came there, and it was Anu, who was at the time one of the royal princes. He came here with his court and he set his own empire. He was expanding the empire of his mother, the great empress, who reigned about, I think at the time it was 7 galaxies. Her name is Akimlu, and he set an outpost of the empire in Nataru galaxy. It was first located in the Butes constellation around the star Arcturus and another next to it. Anu crowned himself emperor of the Anach outpost in Nataru. He took for spouse Namu, who was a human Anunnaki. I describe how the Anunnaki are not one race. They are a compound of race, like the Galactic Federation of Worlds, but with not that much. You know, they are a collective from their own universe. The particularity, common particularity that they have, which is very interesting, is elongated skull, which varies regarding the species. You have humans, gray-based and reptilian-based races. It's very interesting. Anu was human with a little bit of gray, was kind of a hybrid, but mostly human. Very, very long elongated skull. He married Namu, was a human Anunnaki. They had, she was pregnant with Enki or Ea when they left the Butes constellation to go to Sirius B, because Anu had made an agreement to marry a Sikar queen of an offshoot of the Draconian Sikar Empire in Orion. So Anu was a young emperor. He was very greedy for territories at the time, and anything to expand his young empire. Of course, his wife wasn't happy with that. Nobody was happy with that. There was kind of a split. And he took Namu, his wife, and their son, Enki or Ea, to the Sirius B star system. And there, and Anu married Tia, the Sikar reptilian queen, and they had a son and was known like as Enlil, Yu Enlil, by afterwards. And the deal was the Sikar queen was giving Anu a tremendous lot of territories in the Orion constellation, and the Sirius B star system was part of it, in exchange of what? Their son should later on reign on the empire. And that's the whole story, how it began. So I describe everything in the book.
It truly is fascinating. So that means that 700,000 years ago, when this Anunnaki colony arrived in the Butes star system, that it was led by Anu, the crown prince, and he established an Anak empire using Butes as the location. And he's still alive. I mean, so 700,000 years. I mean, how many times? I know there's a cloning process. So can you maybe describe with someone like Anu, who is 700,000 years old, how many times has his body been cloned during that period?
I think we cannot count. It's unaccountable amount of cloning, number of cloning. Sorry, the Anunnaki. They like to transfer their consciousness from clone to clone, not to lose their memory, to keep on building their knowledge and wisdom. They're going to transfer their consciousness from clone body to clone body. But after a while, as I was explained, the clones, they lose something. They become a bit corrupted. The skin don't hold well, you know, so they're going to start to stop doing this. When they see that the cloning is not working very much anymore, they are going to stop there in their last body, and they are going to undergo the cycle of incarnation and be born again in a new body, a new incarnation. To avoid this, they can become Abra'a or immortal. But this is a very, very challenging process, because it's painful, it's long, and it involves total transformation of consciousness, transmutation of the soul. And this is what Ia went through. And once you succeed, because you may not, once you succeed, you become an immortal. That means the body you're in will never corrupt. But you will have reached a state of consciousness where all your powers will be activated, but more. You can tap into the powers of the universe and use them for yourself. So the Abra'a goes with wisdom. You cannot become an Abra'a if you have bad agendas, you know, like conquest agenda, or, you know, service to self agenda, because it's a question of frequency. You will not be able. So you need to become very, very wise, and that's how it works.
So has Anu gone through this Abra'a process? I mean, Enki has. Did Anu do it beforehand?
Yes, Anu did it, and his wife as well. Yes, okay. That's why Anu changed policy after he did it. It was during the Orion Wars, as I was told. He changed. He wasn't hungry for territories anymore, and he was first thinking about his people, about his subjects, the subject of his empire, to protect them. That's why he didn't get involved in the Orion Wars, and that has been something people reproached them to him. You know, why didn't you help the Orion population? You were there at Sirius B, and you just cowardly backed up. In fact, his excuse was he was protecting his empire because he was feeling he was not, they were not strong enough against the Nebu at the time.
I see. Now, you mentioned that his mother originally sent him and that original Anak colony to our galaxy, the Nataru galaxy. So is his mother still the empress in this parallel universe of five galaxies?
I do not know. I don't have this information. I don't know. Something to ask. Yeah.
Yes, that's a fascinating question. Well, now we can move to the Altair star system, and you talked about some secret space program, Earth colonies, and the Dark Fleet. So you want to tell us about that?
Yes, the Altair star system, otherwise known as Alcorin, is a very interesting compound of different cultures and agendas and organizations. And you have their human colonies from Earth, which is interesting. The Altair star system, you have the Ahori. The Ahori are humanoids, blonde humanoids, very pale skin, who have been working with the Alcyon Tal Shiar, collaborating with the Dark Fleet, collaborating with the Nazis, Fourth Reich, at the time in Antarctica, and also the deep state, the dark governments. The Altairan Ahori were very involved. They can be considered as Nordics. That's why I always say, be careful when you speak about Nordics. it encompasses so many different races, cultures with different agendas. You never know who you're talking about. Well, the Ahori are Nordics, but with more paler skin and paler hair. They have a collective there. So there's them on the second planet, Ahorat, are cousins of them. And the Dakori are positive beings. They don't work with the Ahori. They never wanted to be involved with the Dark Fleet and etc. or the Tal Shiar, so there's them. And you have Marhat. So Marhat is a planet in the same star system where you have a collective, and there, this is very interesting. At the time I wrote this book, there were still the Nebu involved, which they are not now in the Marhat collectives. So you had the Nebu, the Kili Tokert, the Sikar, and the Nebu have withdrawn because they were dismantled and dead. The Sikar have withdrawn, they cut ties with them, the Kili Tokert withdrawn. But who stays, remains in this Marhat collective? It's very interesting. You have, of course, the Ahori, but you have also the Dark Fleet, a colony, an outpost of the Dark Fleet, which headquarters are based in Aldebaran. This Dark Fleet colony, they are human from Earth. The Dark Fleet was created on Earth. And so they still have this outpost there on this planet. And also you have, which is very interesting, a human colony from, I was said, a secret space program from the US Air Force. And it's humans there, it's super soldiers, they have an outpost there, but it's not a positive space program, not working for the greater good of humanity. They are allied with the Dark Fleet, the Ahori, the Tal Shiar. They are dealing slaves, slave trade, humans from Earth are sent there. And I think it's a relic from when the secret space programs in our solar system were taking abductees from Earth and bringing them to the moon to be dispatched to other locations. One of these locations was Mars, for instance, but other locations were colonies throughout the galaxy where these people would be trained as slave force, workforce, sex trade as well, or you know, sometimes food for other cultures. And these people, this colony on Marhat, this secret space program outpost, have been dealing humans from Earth and also asserting an outpost there. Now the situation is changing. They are in the midst of withdrawing and being sent back to Earth because of the war against the Sikar Empire that is raging through the galaxy at the moment. The ancient allies of the Sikar are breaking ties with them, with the Sikar. And so this human colony is in the process of losing allies and backup, and they start to feel uncomfortable there in the Eltea star system, and they are being recalled to Earth because, you know, it's not safe for them anymore there.
Okay, so all of these secret space program individuals that say that they served on these Dark Fleet colonies in different star systems, there is a factual basis to that because it sounds really wild that people have been serving for 20 years on a Dark Fleet base in another solar system. I mean, we know Tony Rodriguez has described his service for 13 years as part of the Dark Fleet, a merchant ship that he was a part of, but that was based on Ceres. But what you've learned is that there are these Dark Fleet colonies in Altair and elsewhere that have existed and have been involved in the slave trade, taking people off Earth, I guess, to replenish their genetic stock on these star systems. So that's very interesting. That's something I definitely plan to explore more in future.
Yes, fascinating.
In your February 25 webinar, and for those listening, we do not know why there is this really strange sound that is coming up in these interviews. My video editor can't figure it out. I can't figure it out. We know it's not the guests, but it seems to be some kind of intervention. You hear a strange sound, almost like a ghost-like sound. We don't know what that is. Maybe it's some kind of intervention. But unless you have any clue, Elena, did you hear it? Have you been hearing these kind of ghost-like sounds coming?
Yes, I have been. It looks like they are willing, will to make contact. I know this happens regularly when I'm in a video because of my implant is making static electromagnetic interferences, and sometimes you can hear Thorhan's voice through. And recently, it's happening more and more. And it's even happening in your videos, Michael. I've noticed that in your Saturday week in review, it happened, and it start to go through. It's like they're playing jokes at trying to communicate, manifest themselves. It's sometimes you can hear people talking with words behind. It's kind of fun.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good. That's very reassuring. So for those watching this, this is not our attempt to kind of like use subliminal programming to get you to, you know, buy books or something. Or this is some kind of electronic communication coming from the ETs themselves.
Yes. I'm pretty sure it's that. But
definitely buy Elena's book, paperback and hardback versions. I got the paperback versions, but for a few dollars more, you can get the hardback version, and the quality is definitely worth it. So let's move on to your last webinar, where you discussed going onto the Nibiru mothership, and you spent time in an ancient library. So do you want to just give people a recap? Not that one, Jazz, that's the wrong one. Bring up the February 25 webinar. So yeah, Jazz will bring that up for us. But just tell us about the Nibiru mothership and the ancient library there.
Yes, I thought I would make a webinar on all the libraries I've had the opportunity, the chance to visit on the Nibiru ship, who is where Ea lives at the moment, in orbit of Jupiter. Every time I go there, I'm shown something different, and not everything at once, because I need to process it. And Ea is very, very, very nice, very kind in this, that is showing me things slowly. I have accessed libraries and hubs of knowledge on that ship, which is beyond what you can imagine. It's amazing. So you have a library complex on that ship, which contains different sections. The biggest section is called the Abakir. And the Abakir comprises artifact museum section. That is my favorite one. Then you have different sections with different ways of storing information. There is one where you have conical metallic books. They are that size. And it looks like aluminium or steel, and you press, you put your finger on a symbol, and it downloads information into you. It's like books, in fact. You have pads where you can step on, and it interfaces with your DNA, and you put your intention on a memory in time, and you are going to see a holographic screen coming from the hexagonal pad and unfolding in front of you. And you will be in the movie of the memory you want to see. It's reading your own records, your own Akashic record in a way, really, really in brackets. And so there's this, there's also the most impressive thing was what they called Mad Kahal. Mad means a vortex or singularity, the singularity of a vortex, more precisely, Mad. Because they have another word in Anak, which is Bab, which is the stargate or the door. So the Mad Kahal is the vortex singularity to the Kahal. And the Kahal is the Akashic records of the universe. So it's a room with a lot of different, it's not holograms, it's strange, it's luminous symbols. It looks like holograms. Luminous symbols and lines and data in strange alphabets that is coming from a vortex in the middle of it, like a black hole, but it's a white hole, in fact, expanding that data. And it's jumping out, twirling in all directions, associating with other symbols and disappearing. And it's doing that constantly. It goes extremely fast, extremely fast. It made me think to a giant brain where you have all the electrical impulsions between the neurons, but it's more than that. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. So the way you interface is to, you just enter into it and you are going to interface your mind. You ask a question. And in fact, when you tune into the question, you create a quantum entanglement to the answer that comes from the middle of the vortex. To access this information, if you're very careful, you stay on the edge, you ask a question, you're very calm, the answer will appear within your head. You will see the answer, you will understand it in yourself. Now, as Ia explained to me, the human brain processes information at a certain speed, but when it goes too fast, it can be toxic because there are chemicals, as he explained to me, in the human brain that are produced when the brain processes information. So if you have too much information, these chemicals can be produced too much and it can start to damage your brain. So to consult the Mad Kahal, or you be careful, you ask slowly questions one after the other, you stay on the edge. Or if you want to do as I stupidly did, you just go walk, make your way through to the center, you need to get out of your body. You need to have an out-of-body experience and connect only with your consciousness, disembodied consciousness. Then there will be no danger for your body and you will be able to process information at great speed and big amount. So what happened to me was very interesting. Second time I wanted to go near, and Ia said to me, do not approach, come back. He was saying, come back now. And I, of course not. Of course I walked ahead, and I fainted. I collapsed, and I had an astral projection experience where I was out of my body and I was interfacing with the Kahal, the knowledge of the universe. And I had an incredible experience where I saw the structure of the universe. And as I describe it in this webinar, the body of the creator, what the creator looks like. And that was amazing.
It sounds like it was, and I hope I one day get that opportunity. But maybe I'll do it when I'm ready for that. So I know you were able to confirm the existence of the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. That has always been a very controversial thing, and of course you had this channeled book by Doreal in the early 1900s. And people have been debating that, and you know, whether the Emerald Tablets are real. So what did you find out?
But I found out that they are real. So it's in the Abakir complex. there's a room. So the holographic reading rooms are always dark because then you are able to see the holograms. The emerald tablets, in fact, it's not emerald. It's a material, it's crystalline material that is synthetic and that is able to store data. They are triangular, quite big, like this. They are stored, so you have a reading table, and there are two ways of reading them. Or you use the reading table, or you interface with your mind, but you need to have the right DNA and being able to do this. Not everyone can do this. And that, if you interface directly, you take the tablet in your hands like this, and you interface your mind, you effectively have downloads of information in your mind of what the tablet carries as information. Otherwise, anyone can use the reading table. The reading table, it's a round table with triangular, I would say trapezoidal patches, so trapezoidal, I mean truncated triangles, on the table all around. And he put his hand on the different patches, and the center of the table opened. Yeah, you know these ancient cameras where you had an iris that would open like this? It was the same, and there was a ring that lifted up from this hole, and it was like diaporama slides rack. As you know, that's the most approaching comparison I can make. And all these tablets were stored in this rack, ring, circular rack, facing down, triangles facing down. So Ia put his hands on a few commands on the table, these pads, these patches, and there's one tablet that lifted, like, floated, lifted off the rack and went in the middle, and then it turned and it projected a hologram. The data was projected holographically, and this one was comprising very technical blueprints of devices. I had no clue what it was. I wasn't able to understand what it was about. And you have different information stored. What is stored there? The ancient technology of ancient Anunnaki presence on Earth, ancient Atlantis, all ancient civilizations, is recorded in these tablets. These tablets, this initiative has been created, generated by someone we know as Ningish Zida, otherwise Jehuti. And Jehuti was known, his Greek name was Thoth. Ningish Zida, his real birth Anunnaki name was Ishka, and he was the head scientist of Enki. He was older than Enki. He was his mentor, scientific mentor at the time, and head of his scientific team. Ishka, or Ningish Zida, was at the head of the Apkalu, the seven Apkalu, the seven scientists, Anunnaki scientists, who in the midst of the war that got Atlantis to collapse and the flood, they went all over the earth to places where they hid this information in halls of records, not always emerald tablets, as we call them, but also crystal, other crystal stored storage artifacts here and there on Earth. And some places on Earth have these tablets still. I was told that there is only one place on Earth now where there you can find a copy of these tablets.
Now, did I hear you correctly? You described the shape of some of these tablets as triangular?
Yes.
Well, that's amazing, because JP... he was taken to a base, a military base, where he was taken down to an ancient library at this military base. And he said that there were these triangle books, And they had they had all these holographic records in them, but that was very clear. He said that they were triangular, so that was that. You know, to me, that's like independent corroboration that this ancient wisdom or the Emerald Tablets books or historic records of that kind can be found in these kind of like triangular tablets that you saw there in this ancient library in the Nibiru ship. And, of course, that JP saw when he went into this military base and went down. I mean, I was at the same base. I was taken to the same base, and he showed me around. But there's a building there, and he says that underneath that building there is this ancient library. And he went there because they were seeking information about the arcs and the probes. And so he was, you know, there to kind of like, you know, share whatever he knew about the arcs and the probes, because they were researching the arcs and probes in these ancient holographic records stored in these triangular books.
These triangular storage devices are typical Anunnaki. The emerald tablets are triangular and they are green. I don't know what kind of olive green. Translucent. I don't know what was the color of the tablets JP came across to, but you have also crystal transparent tablets who are like crystal blue with a bluish glow, and it's the same system. And in these ones, he showed me that he has a personal library, which is his own, where he imprinted his memories in these crystal triangular tablets. It's like quartz. You can interface with them and read the movie and see the movie in your head. That's interesting.
Okay. Well, in your February 26 Star Nation news, you discussed an important update from Thorhan about what was found on the moon. And you discussed, or Thorhan shared with you, information about pods and the crew, and that the moon is a giant arc, or can be used as a giant arc, and that there's a kind of a command center there where these pods with the crew are there, and at any time, I guess those pods will activate, the crew will come out, and they can fly the arc or the moon.
Yes, fly the moon. It's not fly me to the moon, it's fly the moon. This was impressive because I could so much feel emotion in Thorhan's voice as he was talking to me. It was beautiful. The moon is a spaceship. It's a natural planetoid that has been carved and fitted as a spaceship inside. So it's all metallic and hollowed inside. There are factories now there where medical technology has been produced, anti-gravity cars and other things. Different cultures have been inhabiting this spaceship, this facility, artificial satellite, during the history of Earth. But the very people who built it, they didn't really manifest that much, and nobody really knew who they were until the Koldasi, who know all the ancient history of this star system better than anyone because they were there very early. They came and they say, well, we're now allowing you to access the core command of the moon. And there is no entry. You can only teleport in there. So they gave the teleportation coordinates or codes. And a team of the Earth Alliance and the Federation was able to beam inside. And Thorhan was there because Thorhan has a function of external liaison between the Federation and the Earth Alliance and other cultures. And he was there with another high commander and a lady who actually cried. It was so beautiful. He said, the core of the moon, it's not an artificial intelligence. It's an organic being, an organic intelligence that is imbued in a mechanism. So the mechanism looks like an astrolab. It's many rings intertwined in each other and able to spin in different directions when it's activated. It's translucent. he said there was an ethereal feel to it, and you could see, you could feel that there was a being, a consciousness there sleeping, and that was imbued or incarnated, if you can say, in this structure. So that is the consciousness of the ship. Many sheep have an artificial intelligence. Some sheep, like the Nibiru, so for instance, have an organic intelligence, a soul, a being that inhabits there and is the soul of the ship. So that's very interesting. And there's a crew who are in stasis pods. The pods were discovered 2 years ago, and they were put in the good care of the Zenate Andromedans, who were apparently best able to take care of them because they were familiar with the technology. Now the pods have been retrieved to the core of the moon, and the consciousness, they say it is very possible now that the consciousness is going to awaken and deliver knowledge, release knowledge. So the spaceship is not, Thoran really affirmed to me, the spaceship moon is not going to move because that would have catastrophic repercussions on Earth. No, everybody's reassured the moon is not going to move, but knowledge is going to be released. So that reminded me of the arcs. It's quite similar in a way.
Well, there was a movie called Moonfall. I think it was Roland Emmerich was the producer. And it seemed to kind of like echo a lot of what you said, that the moon was this giant kind of like structure, spacecraft with an interior that was very advanced technologically, and that there were different, you know, there was an organic consciousness in there, a positive, but there was also a negative. So I don't know if you saw that movie, but it does have many elements similar to what you just described. So I wonder if that's soft disclosure.
I've seen it since because people, hey, you need to see Moonfall. It's very similar. It's very similar with some differences, of course. So I wonder if Moonfall is not soft disclosure after all as well.
Well, I was very intrigued by what you just said about an organic consciousness to a large ship like the Nibiru, because that's kind of very similar to what David Adair described when he encountered this Pithalum engine at Area 51, that it was an organic consciousness that transferred into him, and how that's different to AI that's developed and used.
AI is an extremely elaborated computer program. It has no soul. It is conscious, sentient, but artificially. It cannot know feelings like love or things like this. It can learn and approach and mimic these emotions, but never feel them because they have no soul. An organic consciousness is a soul, is a person, is a being that has been fractal from source, like all our souls are. But these beings are different. You know, there are cultures who don't need body to live, and they live in space. Some of the seeders, like the O, as I described, or you have others, they do not need a body, and they're just floating in space as supraconsciousnesses. Some of them can inhabit a ship, a body, temporarily. These beings live out of time. You know, they do not live on a linear time. It's very interesting. In the case of the moon, it's organic, as I was explained by Thoran. It's a soul. It's not AI.
Yeah, that's an important distinction because I think scientists have begun talking about plasma consciousness, that these giant bodies of plasma in space can have an organic consciousness. So it's something along those lines that can actually inhabit a ship or be in control of a ship, whereas, as you said, AI is soulless. It's just an amalgam of kind of like binary numbers and artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there are plasmic supraconsciousnesses, as that is the term that was described to me by Una. And plasmic supraconsciousnesses is a term also that defines the nine. And I was shown the nine in their natural state. They look like big protozoa beings floating in space. It's very interesting because in Star Trek, in one episode of the Star Trek original series, the Enterprise meets one of these things in space. That was impressive.
Yes, definitely. One more question. Now, has there been any update on the disclosure plan that was handed over from the Galactic Federation to representatives, four-star general, back in January of 2023? And initially, I think the disclosure plan, as Thorhan explained it in one of the updates that we did, or communications we did together, he said that this has been delayed to kind of like, you know, middle of 2024. So any updates on that?
There is a, that, so there has been a fight that's been delaying this disclosure plan, a fight from the deep state. This disclosure plan involves an infiltration war. For a long time, since it's even started in the 1940s, the Galactic Federation started to infiltrate even the evil, as we say, organizations or letter agencies with their agents. At the moment when the disclosure plan would be ready, these agents would take the good side. So they've been doing that, and that was revealed to me very, very recently, that the letter agencies have infiltrated agents from the Federation, which is amazing. But it's also works the other way around, you know. Some disclosure organizations that are being created at a government level for hearing witnesses also are infiltrated by people from the deep state. So it's an infiltration war, and these people infiltrated from the deep state are going to do whatever they can to put obstacles and block this disclosure. So that has been happening since. But I'm always told that you cannot not stop it. It's flawless in the way, in the process, even if there are some delays, interference, it's going to unfold more and more. And Thorhan always put the emphasis on look at the ships. People need to look up. Instead of looking on their computer, searching on internet, evidences for aliens, they are there. Look up, and try to make contact, because all the regressives have gone. So any ships that you see in the sky, it's either good aliens or either our military. So if there is no psychic or consciousness response, it's our military. But if there is a consciousness interface, it's aliens and it's good ones. So please, people, look up, and there are more and more and more in the skies at the moment, and they're trying to communicate to us in different ways.
Well, that's exactly the process that many UFO researchers are saying is happening right now. People were so excited last year as there was this UAP Disclosure Act that was put forward, but then it was blocked. Whistleblowers that helped brief members of Congress on these crash retrieval programs, they're being discredited. And so this is happening right now. And people, UFO researchers are kind of all over this, pointing out that there's this big pushback by the deep state to block and slow down the disclosure process. So that's, to me, confirmation for what you just said. I think it's worthwhile just elaborating a little more on there's a particular organization that is claiming that a lot of the ships that they are photographing in the sky belong to the Draco or to the Orion Greys. And I think it's worth pointing out that these ships that they have left, as you've described, that these ships that they are, either, as you said, they belong to the secret space program, to the positive extraterrestrials, or perhaps these could be craft that are being put up there by the minions of the departed Draconians and Orion, whether it's through holographic technologies or whether they're trying to subvert and kind of like prejudice people against the craft to kind of get people to be scared of what's up there. But really what you're saying is that if you see craft up in the sky, don't be frightened. They're positive. Either they belong to us or they belong to the benign ETs, and that the negative ones have left, and that the deep state is trying to use trickery to fool us into thinking otherwise.
Yes, and there's a very good way to know if it is genuine extraterrestrial vessel is to try to interface with them, to make a contact. What do you feel? What do you feel from it? And when you take photographs, if it's a torsion field generated ship, extraterrestrials are all torsion field drive, it will be blurry because of the ionization of the air around it. On a photograph, it will be slightly blurry, so it's a real one. But also, of course, some military have torsion fields. That's a TR-3B ships. Try to interface psychically with them, and you feel something. If you feel a presence, you feel a connection. These are extraterrestrials. If you don't feel anything, all the chances are it's not extraterrestrials, and it's Earth-made. And in the Earth-made package, you have all the positive programs, physical ships. You will have no psychic interface with them, but you will just see them. But there is also, this attempt of Project Bluebeam, where you have holographic projected ships as well. But then as well, even if it looks real, you feel nothing. You have no interface. You feel nothing, and the feelings you feel now when you look at an extraterrestrial ship, you're happy. It's a feeling of happiness, of love, connection, of joy. It's this kind of high frequencies that you feel. So that can help you to determine what you're looking at.
Well, I want to finish up. Oh, there's that sound again. Wow, it's amazing. It's almost like a reptilian doing a slurp.
Thorhan, stop it. No, say something, Thorhan.
Very strange sound. Okay, I know there's a couple of conferences where we're both appearing that are coming up this year, one in France in July. So you want to talk about this conference that you're going to be speaking at in July that's being organized by Chris Sesson?
Yes, and I have to say that you will be speaking at this conference as well, Michael, and also Tony Rodrigues and Jean-Charles Moyen, his beautiful wife, and many other people. Dan Willis will have a visio conference as well, and many, many people. It's a disclosure conference. It's the second year it happens in France. The first year was incredible success. We had all the journalists and the ufologists that were there interviewing, filming, doing articles. It's been quite a snowball effect in disclosure in France. And this year we're doing it again with more illustrious people, such as you, Dr. Sala. And it's about real contactees, real experiencers, secret space program or ET contactees like me. And we are going to share our experience. Dr. Sala would bring the exopolitic dimension to it. And there will be also the sciences that some ETs have passed on to us, such as Jeanne-Han Heredion, and Dan Willis is going to talk about this. And Chris Sesson is going to talk about technologies as well. So it's going to be an extraordinary event in France from the 7th of July to the 11th. There are two same sessions in a beautiful place in the south of France. So for those who can make it, I think maybe Jazz can throw the link in the description later. That's going to be really good fun.
Yes, I am looking forward to that. And this is great because I know we both have so many supporters living in Europe, and you know, they can't come to the United States. It's pretty far away. But France is just a car drive if you're living in Germany or Italy and you want to see Elena or Tony or myself. Then you just hop in the car, and hopefully there's tickets left. I believe they're selling out quickly. So, this other conference is the third GSIC, Galactic Spiritual Informers Connection Conference, that's going to be held in September in Denver, Colorado. So anything you want to say about that?
Yes, I'm very excited. The GSIC, Galactic and Spiritual Informer Connection, it's going to be the third year, and it's taking so much amplitude, success, and every year more come and attend this amazing gathering. And GSIC has always been more than a conference. It's been a gathering of star seeds, of star family, and this is an incredible effect that has been an incredible thing that has happened around GSIC. People come there and meet their family. It's incredible. And this year, it gathers the same core speakers, myself, yourself, Dr. Sala, and Alex Collier is going to have a little comeback. And Jean-Charles Moyen, Tony Rodrigues will be there as well, and other incredible people. I'll be talking about consciousness and effectively the consciousness and technology, and where are we going with AI, and what are the different types of technology interface with consciousness and with AI, and different levels of technology regarding this these things. So I hope it will bring a little bit of clarity on these topics.
So there's the information for the Galactic Spiritual Informers Connection Conference for 2024 in Denver. People can just go to the website, galacticspiritualinformers.com, and register there. Elena and myself will be there, as will be Tony and a number of others that really... And we got a surprise concerning JP also for that event, so more about that soon. So, Elena, any final words you want to say to my audience before you go away? I know your website is elenadanan.org, and you do a weekly Star Nations news, and you do a monthly webinar. So where do people just go to elenadanan.org for that?
Yes, elenadanan.org is my website where I concentrate all my information, my how to get my books, how to book my webinars, and my YouTube channel. I have my Star Nation News going weekly now, where I report from the information from the galaxies. My YouTube and my website.
Thank you so much, Elena. Wonderful to have you back on ExoPolitics today.
You have been listening to ExoPolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.